You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And many thanks to Sam and to Dr. Mike, who filled in for me on Monday and Tuesday. Monday, Louise and I were out in Portland watching our oldest daughter graduate with her degree as a nurse practitioner. It was the all of our kids have graduated in various forms from various schools, and it was the first one I've ever been to. I've been through just like I was out of the country half the time, and it was a big deal. They're boring. They're incredibly boring. You sit there for 3 hours listening to everybody give speeches, but it's not boring when your kid walks on the stage. So anyway, it was wonderful, and then we flew home yesterday. So I'm back. I'm glad to be back, and so that's what's up. The United States is now officially roughly half in poverty. I mean, we haven't been this bad off in a long, long time. Is it time to revisit Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights? FDR's Second Bill of Rights, very straightforward. I'll play the audio for you a little later on, but just a quick snapshot. He said that everyone should have the right to a job and a fair wage. In other words, when capitalism fails or hiccups, as it periodically does, it's called the business cycle, the government should be the employer of last resort. Franklin Roosevelt said the best welfare program is a job. Number two, farmers should be paid a fair price for their work, which in this modern day means get the speculators, people who are not actually counterparties to a trade, out of the speculating business. Number three, businesses should be free from monopoly. Good luck on that. America used to be a nation full of small businesses. You could drop into any city in America, look around, and know exactly where you were, because before Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982, America was a nation of small businesses. Now every industry is dominated by two, three, four companies. And number five, Franklin Roosevelt said we should have the right to health care. Not the privilege, the right. And number six, he said that we should have the right to a safety net, old age, unemployment, economic security. Old age, economic security, and unemployment economic security. Number seven of his Bill of Rights, that everybody should have the right to an education. In other words, we invest in our intellectual infrastructure all the way through college. And he said, if we do this, he said an old British judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. If we do this, if we are no longer necessitous, if we are no longer hungry or homeless or uneducated or unable to find a job or unable to get health care when we need it, or living in poverty and living on cat food in our old age, then we are free. That in any of those circumstances, you are not free. Tom Pawkin has some specific thoughts on this. He's the Republican candidate for governor of Texas, former state chair of the Texas Republican Party and the Texas Workforce Commission. He's the author of Bringing America Home, and his website is Tom Pawkin. It's spelled P-A-U-K-E-N, fortexas.com. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Tom, good to be back with you.
Thank you for joining us. And by the way, I wanted to mention at the top of the show, today is the 45th anniversary of the death of Robert F. Kennedy, who I think would have taken our nation in a far more progressive direction had he lived. Your thoughts on Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights?
Well, my thoughts are twofold, really. The point you're making about people are not getting employed, they're not getting good middle-class jobs. To borrow a phrase from my friend, the late Congressman Jack Kemp, who took it from John F. Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats. You've got to have a vibrant private sector in order to pay for our government benefits and services, and we got a tax system in place that puts the financial engineers in charge and is a killer for small businesses and U.S. manufacturers because it rewards debt while punitively taxing capital investment, employment, and savings here in the U.S. You need to reverse that. We're exporting prosperity and American jobs overseas.
Now, respectfully, you've got your metaphor upside down or backwards. The rising tide that lifts all boats is the tide of infrastructure. It's the tide of a good public education provided to everybody by the government. John Kennedy talked about we're paying three-quarters of the cost of all new hospitals and schools. We're building roads.
Tom, who pays for it if you don't have, if you've got a stagnant private sector? You can't pay for your government benefits and services.
The reason companies are moving to China instead of to Burma is because China went ahead and made their investment in their physical infrastructure. You can take a high-speed train across China right now, the same distance as Chicago to New York, in about 9 hours. You can't do that in the United States. Companies are looking at China going, this is pretty cool. We'll work here.
I beg to disagree with you, because you've got a huge tax advantage that China, Germany, which has a high wage and labor costs, has got a strong manufacturing sector, but they've got a 17% or actually a 19% tax advantage over us because they have a border adjusted consumption tax. And what I favor is getting rid of our corporate tax, which is 35% and 7.65% employer portion of the payroll tax, replacing it with a border adjusted consumption tax. You could do it at 8 to 9%, so all goods and services coming into the U.S. are taxed at that price, and all exports get a tax credit against their business consumption tax, and provide incentives for companies that have that money parked overseas to bring it home by allowing them, as long as they put it into capital investment, to expense it against their revenues.
Okay, so you're aggregating a whole bunch of different things, but with regard to German corporations pay a higher tax. They're not faced with a higher tax rate, but they pay a higher effective tax rate than the United States, than the U.S. corporations. We're second lowest among the OECD nations. No, look at it's on the OECD website.
I've seen it.
We're number two from the bottom.
They have a lower corporate tax rate than we do.
They have a lower corporate tax rate, but that's not what corporations pay. Corporations in America buy politicians who build loopholes into the tax code.
And General Electric pays nothing, and they've shipped a lot of jobs overseas. If you go to a border-adjusted consumption tax at 8 or 9%, all of a sudden, General Electric, nobody can game the system anymore.
No, this is where I agree with you. If you're talking about a VAT tax that's reversible at the borders, which is how Germany does it, it's how Japan does it, it's how South Korea does it, it's how China does it. Then yes, we should do that. But good luck telling any Republican anywhere in this country that you want to add a new tax.
No, you're going to get rid of the other tax, and then the IRS won't be doing what they're doing now, which is targeting conservative groups of a variety of fronts. You can replace the corporate tax, income tax.
The IRS is not targeting
consumption tax. At least get IRS out of business affairs.
The IRS would be managing your consumption tax.
And the second thing I would do is I think it's just the opposite of growing government. I think the mood is out there of decentralization of government. I think that particularly with the concentration of power, and I'm not talking about just Roosevelt or LBJ or Nixon. Bush did it with what they call big government conservatism, which I call an oxymoron. Obama administration's done it. Why not go back towards decentralization, have the federal money go back to the states and local communities on a pro rata equitable basis, and let people in California or Texas or wherever decide how to take care of the people in their states?
So if somebody is born in West Virginia, if they have the misfortune of being born into a poor family in a poor state, tough luck, Charlie.
No, not at all. I mean, West Virginia, you've been to Washington, Tom. You're in and out of there all the time.
I live in Washington.
That is a recession-proof society. You've got this huge bureaucracy, and I see even among Democrats and independents, I mean, I see it on the education front. There's just so much frustration that all the power is being centralized in Washington, and I'm simply saying send the money back to West Virginia or California or Texas and let the people on a pro rata equitable basis determine take care of their people, their poor people, their not a best.
Tom, I'm gonna leave you with the last word right there and not even rebut it. Tom Paukin,
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
PAUKENFOR4Texas.com is his website. Tom, thanks for dropping by. Oh, it's gone. Okay. One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. In fact, a hardcover free signed copy. How cool is that? That's an extra $3 on eBay when you go to sell the thing. And, no, just joking. Well, maybe not. and which will be sent to you using stamps.com, and that caller could be you. So Shano's favorite caller today, or his randomly selected. I don't know how you do that. You just kind of rattle it around your head, and suddenly a bell goes off, and you go, ah, that one. Yeah. Or what? Yeah, or Jim mentioned. Yeah, okay. All right. You know, I mentioned the FDR Second Bill of Rights, and Tom Paukin basically blew it off, and, you know, we kind of got into a discussion of the minutia of his candidate for governor, but or candidacy and his platform. But I believe that Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights is actually really important and needs to be added to the Constitution. Now, keep in mind, a right is something that government has to put into place legislation to either protect or implement. Right? If you have a right to a job, then Congress has to pass legislation that says, okay, this person doesn't have a job, can't find a job, there are no jobs, so we will hire them. So let's just go through some of these. This is clip number one. This is FDR just basically setting up the concept. And this was in the year before he died. He didn't live long enough to really, really push this hard. But I think this was a really important point. Here's his setup, clip one.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
Now, notice he said, in our day, these things have become accepted. Back in the 30s, I mean, this is Frank Lautenberg just died. Frank Lautenberg was a kid when Franklin Roosevelt was saying this. He was a teenager. And he got it. I mean, people of that generation who are dying off now, tragically. We don't have that wisdom, that knowledge with us anymore. But back then, every American understood that the role of government was, and Franklin Roosevelt made it the role of government, was to guarantee certain rights. And here are some of those rights. This is the right to a job and a fair wage.
Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation.
Remunerative. Yes, sir. I love those. You know, people used to actually use big words. Remunerative is a fancy way of saying good paying job. And, you know, enough to actually live on. That should be a right, not a privilege. A right. He also said that businesses should be free from monopoly. Now, again, look in any city in America, any shopping mall, anywhere you go. And what do you see? Small businesses? Not so much. Maybe occasionally in small town Vermont, but that's about it. What you see is monopoly or duopoly or triopoly, but you know, it's functionally all monopoly. And so Roosevelt said, no, we need to be free from this. We, the individual human beings, have a right, and our small business owners have a right to be free from monopoly. Here he is, clip four.
The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, this is pretty simple stuff. Now, for some reason, Reagan thought, nah, that's, you know, we'll just do the opposite of that, and literally did. But can you imagine, this was the President of the United States saying that this is what it takes to make a free nation, is that free people have these rights. And by the way, to the best of my knowledge, every one of these rights is considered a right in virtually every country in Europe. And you know, most of the fully developed countries of the world, Australia, Canada. He said that you should have a right to a place to live and to decent health care. A right, not the privilege, you know, hey, you get to live on the street. No. A right to home and health care. Here he is.
The right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health.
And Roosevelt actually made the former happen. I mean, you know, he backstopped mortgages. There's a massive mortgage failure disaster going on in 1932 when he came into office because they'd been selling all these five-year, the standard mortgage in the 20s during the Republican administrations of Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover from 1920 to 1932, the standard mortgage was a five-year mortgage with a balloon at the end. But housing prices have been going up so fast from 1920 to 29, it was a bubble. The people would do that. They'd buy it. They'd have the five-year balloon. And then when the balloon got hit, they'd just roll it over. They'd, you know, but all of a sudden, after the crash of 29, you couldn't roll it over. So all these people were stuck with these mortgages. So FDR created a federal agency that bought these five-year mortgages and turned them into 30-year fixed-rate, low-interest mortgages guaranteed by the federal government. That program wound itself up in the 60s or 70s and actually showed a profit to the government. In addition to saving homeowners, he didn't bail out banksters. He bailed out homeowners. And with regard to health care, well, there were efforts made back then. There was conversations about national single-payer health care. How do we do this? The biggest thing, I think, is that hospitals had to be, and health insurance companies had to be not-for-profit in virtually every state in the country. We'll continue this conversation after the break and get your calls and thoughts on it as well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Is it time not only to undo the Reagan Revolution, but to finish the revolution that was the New Deal? Well, this falls into the category of weird ways to get publicity, I think. There's a guy in Alabama, Alabama State Senator Shadrach McGill. From his photo, I'd say he's probably in his mid-30s. He defines himself as a upstanding, staunch Christian lawmaker. He's married. And one night at 1 o'clock in the morning, a couple of strippers came by his house. His wife didn't find that funny. He says he didn't either. And then he says a few weeks later, or a few days later, he saw a woman who was having a tire. She was fixing her tire, and he went over to offer to help. And it turned out she was a stripper. And he claims he's being stalked by strippers everywhere he goes. All the women he runs into are strippers. Must just be an amazing coincidence, you know. Anyhow, it's the lead story over at Raw Story. Alabama lawmaker says he's being stalked by strippers. I love it. And right underneath it is the headline that says, woman run over after calling police on couple having car sex. It's like, what? Is the moon full? No, actually, it's almost a new moon. We are a week away from Mercury going retrograde, though. That might have something to do with it. Okay, I want to finish up FDR's second New Deal. It'll just take a second, and then we'll pick up some of your thoughts on this, because I got people here who want to tell me I'm crazy, and others who think that this is gonna save America. So we talked about the right to a fair job. He had a thing for farmers. There's not so much farmers anymore. He had business free from monopoly, home and health care. Here's clip number 6. This is FDR about the social safety net. Here you go.
The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment.
Old age, sickness, accidents, and unemployment. That's quite literally a social safety net. And number 7, good education. This is fascinating. This is clip number 7.
The right to a good education.
Yeah. Pretty straightforward, right? But everybody should have the right to, not the privilege, not if you're born into the wealthy family, not if, you know, like George W. Bush, not if your dad was a Yale alumni or alumnus or whatever, but actually a good education. And he went on to say that this is going to mean, if we do this, this will mean security and peace. This is Franklin Roosevelt.
All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
I agree. I absolutely agree. In fact, I would say one of the things that drives the neocons and the warmongers is the lack of security at home. People are experiencing free-floating anxiety, fear. They're three paychecks away from the poorhouse. They're one bad doctor's visit away from bankruptcy, and they know it. From being homeless, from being, you know, whatever it may be, from having Mitt Romney ship their company to some other country. And people know it, and they're frightened by it. So, Justin in Perryton, Texas, it says you disagree with me. What's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on? You were talking about the jobs being a right for all Americans and stuff like that. The problem with that is what do you do with the millions that don't want to work, that just want the government handouts? What do you do with the bad workers? Can you not fire them since it's their right to have the job?
No, I'm not. There's two separate issues with regard to people who are bad workers. Sure, you can fire them, and if somebody's not doing a good job, I'm not saying that you have a right not to be fired. I'm saying you have a right to a job. And with regard to people who don't want to work, yes, there's always going to be. I mean, this is Ben Franklin in his autobiography. I thought it was one of the most fascinating parts of his autobiography is when he first went over to England, and they had. This was in the 1750s. 50s maybe, and they had a fairly extensive social welfare program, you know, people on the dole basically, you know, and he wrote about how he felt that maybe that was discouraging some people from working. There's always going to be a small subset of Americans. It's called the hardcore unemployed, the long-term unemployed. There's different phrases for it, and it typically is somewhere between 1% and 3.5%, and you find the same thing in pretty much every country. Of people who would just as soon not work. And if you give them, you know, some minimal, even a pretty crummy standard of living, they'll take that rather than working. And I would say that, you know, that's those people are probably suffering from some sort of mental illness, and that's a small price to pay for the rest of us living in a decent society. And that's the decision that most other countries have made. And but you know, how many people do you know, Justin? I don't know anybody personally, and I look back through my life at all the years I've been on this planet, and I maybe one or two people out of the thousands or fives of thousands, many thousands of people that I've known throughout my life, who, given a choice between a good job that they enjoy doing and that pays well, versus sitting around on just scraping by on food stamps. And, you know, watching TV and eating bonbons, which chooses the latter. I think it's very rare, frankly.
Well, I think that comes to personal accountability. I mean, you make decisions in your life, whether you're 17 or 18 or 30 or 40, you know.
Yeah, that's all rhetorical, though. The reality is that most people like to work. Most people don't want to sit around all day. Most people don't want to, you know,
Everybody wants a great job, but...
Well, let's provide them.
If you drop out of high school at 17, why should I have to pay for you to have a good job 20 years later?
Well, if somebody drops out of high school at 17 and they're capable of building roads and our roads are falling apart, they're capable of building bridges and our bridges are falling apart, why not put them to work doing that and give them a decent wage and let them raise a family? And I mean, just because somebody doesn't go to college doesn't mean that they're any less valuable to society than somebody who does.
I didn't say that, but I'm saying, you know, maybe they didn't want to work, you know.
Maybe they didn't want the education. There are some people who have...
Accountability.
No, there are some people...
Accountability.
There are some people who fit into our educational system really well, and there are some people, because of the way their brains are wired or whatever, who don't fit into our education system really well, and that shouldn't be the criteria for how much they get paid and whether or not they're working, in my opinion. And I think that we need strong trade schools in this country, like they have in European countries. And we need, free college in this country. And we need decent jobs that pay well for somebody who's simply a high school graduate or even a high school dropout. And, when I was growing up, I mean, half my friends' parents worked at Oldsmobile or General Motors. We lived in Lansing. I mean, it was kind of, that was the major industry in town. And a lot of those parents were immigrants or the sons of immigrants, and they, a lot of them didn't finish high school, but they raised their kids. They built the middle class. And I'm just telling you, people would rather work than just, sit around and eat chocolates. And that small percentage of people who aren't going to work, I'm not disputing with you that they exist. I'm saying that subsidizing that tiny percentage, which is going to be just a few pennies a year out of our taxes, is a small price to pay for everybody not living in constant insecurity and fear. And if the government became the employer of last resort so that our unemployment rate went from its current 14-15%, and in the minority communities it's as high as 50% in some areas, if it went from that down to 5%, what you would see is the labor market would tighten up, you'd see more people working, you'd see more people paying taxes, you'd see, the budget deficit would go away, wages would start rising because there would be competition for workers. I see absolutely no social or economic speaking as a business person, business downside to that. I'll have more customers. More people will want to subscribe to my podcast because they'll be able to afford to. I mean, because the proof of it is that we did this in the United States. We did this from 1933 until till the late 40s, maybe the early 50s. We did this and it worked really well. And other countries do this on a routine basis. And it works really well, and I think that we should consider it. Justin, thanks for the call. I want to get some other people in here. They've got a whole bunch of them online. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, you wanted to quote Ralph Nader?
Yeah, actually, he said, I think it was the other day, 50% of the population is struggling, and he said we're the richest third world country in the world. And also, I wanted to make a comment on what Justin had just said. In Germany, if you were dissatisfied with your job for many years, they just simply dissatisfied. If you came up with a plan, you could get 3/4 of your salary and your education paid for. And, it seems to work very well there. And the German work ethic is one of the best in the world. So I'm not very pessimistic about my fellow worker here, and I'm a worker, and I think that most people do want to work and most people want to contribute. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, John. And I know people who are unemployed. I've known people who are unemployed. One of my kids was unemployed for a while. The company he was working for got merged with another company. They dumped a bunch of people. And he was miserable being unemployed. I mean, he went out and started his own business. It's like being unemployed is no fun. And the vast majority of people, give them a job, they'll take it. And as Franklin Roosevelt said, it's the best welfare plan there is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
When you give people a job instead of a welfare check, it increases their dignity, it gives them an enthusiastic day, and it adds to society. They're doing things. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And, this is interesting. Nate, in Annapolis, Maryland, you believe that everyone has the right to work right now?
Yeah, I do, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. I was not referring to a right to work. I was referring to a right to a job. There's a difference.
Well, then I need you to help me to understand the difference. I argue that everybody right now has the right to exchange their labor for a wage.
That's correct.
I don't understand the difference.
Well, the difference is that, for example, we ran an ad, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago. We had an opening in our little small business. We were looking for somebody to do some writing for us on our TV show. And we probably got somewhere between 200 and 300 responses to this one little one-day, showed up for maybe 6 hours on Craigslist ad. And I'd say 10% of them were actually qualified. And it's just there are so many people right now looking for jobs, and there are so few jobs available that I've talked to people, you know, who have literally put in, you know, thousands of job applications, who have knocked on hundreds of doors, who have tried, you know, dozens and dozens of phone calls. Employers are getting better and better and better at putting up barriers so that people don't get through to them. And so, no, the jobs are not there. We have a structural unemployment in this country right now, which is the unemployment rate is, you know, around 7-8%, 9% in some parts of this country. It's as high as 50% because the jobs simply aren't there. The employers have moved those factories offshore because the tax code has encouraged them to do that, or the that's the principal thing, frankly, or the tax code. Go ahead.
There's a lot of things that you and I actually agree on, although I consider myself pretty conservative. I will say that I wonder, and this is purely speculation because I haven't studied it, but I wonder if, look at the minimum wage. The minimum wage artificially inflates the price of labor, and it does destroy jobs.
No, it doesn't.
Whether or not you like to admit it.
No, there's absolutely no evidence for that, Nate. In fact, if you go back, look at the U.S. Department of Labor statistics and, you know, compare the minimum wage and when it increased to economic activity. What has happened since 1935, when the minimum wage was first put into place, is that every time the minimum wage goes up, over the course of the next 3 years, you see a substantial, a significant, a measurable increase in GDP. And the reason is very predictable. I mean, this is simple economics. People who are earning minimum wage spend 100% of their income. Now, if the 100% of their income that they're spending is, you know, 1% more than it was the previous year, they're going to stimulate the economy 1% more than they did the previous year, because they are the ones who are creating demand in the economy. So the minimum wage, I mean, the minimum wage is actually driving the economy. But what I'm saying is that if you're going to say that you have a right to a job, then somehow that has to be provided. When the private sector fails to provide that, as it is right now, you can do this one of two ways. You can either change the rules. It's like changing the rules of a football game or a soccer game or something. You can either change the rules, which in my case would be changing our tariff policies, our international trade rules, or you can make the government the employer of last resort. We have done both in the history of this country, and they've both worked.
Well, the other thing you're ignoring, Tom, is that the pendulum swings both ways. You know, you raise the minimum wage, that increases the price of labor. Businesses aren't stupid. They're going to pass that cost to increase the price of labor onto their consumers.
So no, you're missing my point, Nate. When you raise the minimum wage, you have people buying more things. When people buy more things, companies make more profit. When companies make more profit, they find ways to be more efficient. They hire more people. When the minimum wage goes up, the economy grows. It does not shrink. And in fact, what we've been seeing since 1980, since the beginning of Reaganomics, is that independent of the minimum wage, we've been seeing the average wage in the United States stagnant while productivity has continued to go up. As productivity goes up, as the profitability of businesses goes up, as the ability to make money, businesses are at an all-time high for productivity and profitability. Stock market is at an all-time high. CEO salaries are at an all-time high. Executives are making more than ever. Investors are making more than ever. All of that money used to be from the George Washington administration until the Ronald Reagan administration. Those people all did very well, thank you very much, but a lot of that used to be shared with workers. Wages and productivity used to track each other. So as productivity went up, so did wages. And since 1980, wages have flattened out and productivity has continued to rise. And what's filled in that gap is all that profit that's going to the top. And as a consequence of that, the middle class is being wiped out. Now, you know, you could slightly raise wages by raising the minimum wage, but I would like to see wages, frankly, tied to productivity.
I agree, and you know what? I think part of it too is the decrease in the activity and the ability of labor unions to protect their members. You know,
to some extent, yeah. But unions prosper in an environment where you've got a tight labor market, because they help mediate that tight labor market. And right now you've got such a loose labor market. There's so many more people looking for a job than there are jobs out there that the unions are in trouble. And, you know, it's like because people are willing to break unions. People are willing to be scared. People are desperate for jobs. And they shouldn't be desperate for jobs. We should be saying, okay, we've got a $2.5 trillion infrastructure deficit in the United States. And that's just to take us back to where we were in the Eisenhower years. And, you know, if we wanted to do like China's doing or Germany or Spain or France and have high speed rail systems, you know, where you can travel at 200 miles an hour in a train that just goes tick, 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 nice and quiet. And you can walk down the aisle and it's just beautiful and quiet and modern. If we wanted to do that, if we wanted to upgrade our air traffic system, if we wanted to upgrade our fiber system. So like in South Korea, where everybody, no matter where you live, you have 100 megabyte downloads, 100 MIPS downloads. And you know, 10 MIP uploads, whereas in America, the average is around 2.5 download and you know, 0.5 upload, and the premium ones are 5 download. If you wanted to build that kind of infrastructure in the United States, it would cause companies to go, this is great. I'm going to move to this community. This is why so many businesses locate in Silicon Valley. You've got good colleges, you've got good infrastructure, you've got good housing, you've got, you know, all that stuff that is provided for by government. So if we need this infrastructure, why don't we put our own people to work building it? Nate, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What is hate speech? Very interesting question. We have a fellow who... where'd it go? There's no setup for this. Oh, well. Apparently, somebody is being charged with hate speech. In fact, Bill, I'll bet you can tell us all about this. LiveProyer.com, Bill, the Reverend Bill Keller, on the line with us. Hey, Bill.
Tom, how you doing, my friend?
I'm fine. So who is this guy who's being charged with hate speech?
Well, the Muslims have taken a page out of the radical homosexual playbook, and now they're using the government to try to basically silence anybody who dares to speak anything
critical of
Islam.
Who is the guy who spoke? Who's the guy who's being charged with hate speech? Is it you?
Well, nobody as of yet, but the U.S. attorney in the Middle District of Tennessee and three FBI agents are giving a symposium this week in Tennessee talking about how they want to enact laws to make any kind of inflammatory speech against Muslims deemed as hate speech and criminalized. Right. Which is exactly what the homosexual radicals have pretty much been successful in doing over the last few years.
So how would you feel if people were running around saying, you know, Bill Keller is a right-wing wackadoodle, and therefore you should firebomb his house, and then somebody did?
Well, number one, people go around all day long calling me a right-wing wackadoo, and actually I do get about 8 to 10 death threats every month. But you know what? That's, you know, free speech. I got to tell you something, Tom. When you start talking about firebombing people's houses and doing physical harm to people, I think now you are in some dangerous territory.
Well, that was my point. I get death threats too. But the fact of the matter is that I'm still here, and hate speech generally by law, the definition of hate speech doesn't even kick in unless it's associated with an actual crime. So if somebody can track, you know, somebody's speech back to a crime happening or to, you know, a serious intimidation, a limitation of another person's rights, isn't that something that you would defend that is prosecuting that person?
But here's the problem. Nothing I personally have ever said has ever incited people to violence or encouraged people to violence. Matter of fact, that's what the Muslims do. They're the ones that incite people to violence.
How do you know that people are not listening to what you say and haven't listened? I mean, you've said some pretty damn strong things about Muslims.
Sure.
You talk about Islam being a phony religion and it's a lie and all this kind of stuff.
Hell.
All right. So, yeah, phony religion from hell. And so how do you know that that kind of speech isn't going to cause some slightly unbalanced Christian who thinks that they've got the only way to go, or something else. I mean, you know, some Hindu someplace or something, to say, oh, it's the Muslims, huh? And go after them. I mean, I would say that your kind of rhetoric about Islam, which is blanket and general and condemnatory and not at all nuanced, and doesn't point out that the vast majority of Muslims just want to have a decent life. They want their kids to go to a decent school. They want to have a decent job.
Well, you bought into that lie, too, but that's okay.
It's not a lie.
It is a lie.
Listen, come on, Bill, I've been in Muslim nations.
If Muslims had the numbers in this country that they have, like in Saudi Arabia, or let's take Egypt for a fact, they would be living Islam exactly the way it's taught in the mosque, even in this country.
Even in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, the vast majority of Muslims wake up in the morning not thinking, oh, gee, I think I'm going to go out and do something that is religious and weird. They wake up in the morning saying, how can I put food on my table? How can I get a decent education
Absolutely.
For my daughter?
But here's the difference, Tom. The teachings of this false religion have 1,400-year documented history of hatred, violence, terror, and death.
Well, so does Christianity.
Listen, you're a newsman. Go to the news every day, and you can find stories in the news every day where violence is happening around the world, and almost all of it's tied to Islam.
That's nonsense, Bill. I can look at the news every day, and I can see a General Boynton saying, our God, our Christian God, is bigger than your Muslim God, and our country is dropping bombs out of the sky and killing innocent people in faraway countries that all happen to be Muslim.
It has nothing to do with advancing the Christian theology.
Tell that to the Muslims on the receiving end of these bombs when the President of the United States, George Bush, calls it a crusade, and when his general says it's because it's our God is bigger than their God.
And that's the difference.
No. Think about it from their point of view. This is Christian terrorism from their point of view.
There are people like yourself who say
that this is a Christian nation and we are dropping bombs and killing their children.
But it's got nothing to do with advancing Christianity. That's the point, Tom. When these people do their what they do, it's to advance Islam. Go ask Nadal and the Fort Hood shooter. You're going to hear all about that over the next few months as he stands up and tells you exactly what Islam is about. Just like the Times Square bomber, that Fassad stood in that courtroom and told people.
And there
what
is
Islam
no shortage of people like yourself who are, maybe you're not going quite this far, but people who are in that camp who are saying, oh, well, you know, it's okay if we drop bombs on Muslim nations. God forbid we should drop a bomb on Germany or on a Christian nation.
You're talking apples and oranges.
No, what I'm saying you have not.
In terms of dropping bombs, it's about fighting the war on terror. It's
Bill,
got nothing
Jesus'
to do
main
with advancing
message.
The Christian theology.
Bill, you're ignoring what Christ said. His main message was put yourself in the other person's shoes. And
That's
if
not
you
what
were,
he said. What he said is, I'm the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father through me. That's what he said. Everybody likes to parse his words and take part of what he says, but they don't want to live the other part.
Yeah.
If there's a
beam in your eye, don't yell about the mote in your neighbor's eye. And you know, love is the first commandment. All those other things. We can do dueling Bible verses if you want here, Bill. But what you're missing. And I just have to believe that you haven't seriously thought about this. And I would like you to, you know, I doubt you will on the air right now, but I'd like you to seriously consider this tonight and maybe even pray about it. But just imagine you are a person who grew up in a Muslim country and you're a young man, grew up in a Muslim country. Think, hey, this is a good religion. And all of a sudden people from a Christian country are killing you. They put an embargo.
What Christian country?
The United States. We put an embargo on Iraq that killed 500,000 children.
Tom, your premise is wrong. What Christian country?
Do you not assert that the United States is a Christian country?
Absolutely. Not even close. 40 years ago, maybe. Not even now. And also, the other false premise you make there is
Do you not think that most Muslims think that we think we're a Christian country?
Those bombs were not being dropped to further the cause of Christ. That's the key difference. What Islam did on 9/11 was to further the Muslim faith.
No,
what we
it wasn't.
Did in Iraq and Afghanistan was to protect Osama bin Laden terrorism.
Was very explicit. He went back in 1998 when he basically told us what he was going to do. He said he wasn't trying to get recruits to Islam. Come on, you don't do that way. What he said was that we were defiling the holy site, the holy site of Saudi Arabia by having an Air Force base there, which George Bush Sr. put there when he drove Saddam out of Saddam Hussein.
Well,
out
how come Saudi
of
Arabia,
Kuwait,
which is a Muslim country, lets us have a base there?
Well, that, you know, there's a you got a fairly corrupt government there, but why? But George W. Bush actually took Saddam's advice. George W. Bush actually.
Not the United States.
Bill, it doesn't work when we yell over each other. George W. Bush actually took Osama bin Laden's advice and closed that base. But he said that this is it. You're defiling our land, and so you know we're going to kick you until you stop. It's our behavior. It's not our religion.
The ones that let him put it there.
Oh, Bill. Can you? Okay. Bill Keller, founder of LivePrayer.com is the website. All right. Good talking with you, Bill.
Always good, buddy.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And can you imagine if Canada invaded the United States? Would you be out there trying to defend the United States against Canada? I mean, even if they were defending us for what they thought was a good reason? I'm looking at Benedict, this guy's from The Onion, right? No, Bill is dead serious. Yeah. I don't see any evidence of any kind of cuts in Social Security. So, anyway, we'll see where all this goes. Chris in Ayer, Pennsylvania, or Massachusetts, rather. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, no problem, Tom. First of all, on a lighter note, because you've had a tough day. The other day, my wife leaned over and she said, "You know, do you have any fantasies that have gone unfulfilled?" And I said, "Yeah. I want to roll a J with Tom Hartman and Ezra Klein at the same time." So you're one of the smartest men in America, and,
hopefully the day will come when we can legally do it.
Man, listen, you have the producer get my information. I'll put my ass on a plane. Oh, so I didn't mean to curse, sorry.
Yeah.
So the reason I'm calling, though, is because, the thing that I find amazing that you're the only person in any sort of pundancy or talk show or informational network that talks about is how most of these Republican states have actually run tremendous deficits over the last 20 years and plus. What I don't understand
is how come... And they have massive
poverty. Right. And that's where all the long-term poverty is. It's where the lowest... you and I could do this all day. The statistics are staggering.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, why doesn't anyone else, and I don't mean the sensationalist, allegedly liberally biased media that's just sensationalist fluff, not them. How come politicians don't stand up and say, it's arrogant of XYZ state to tell us about fiscal responsibility when a state like West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, Nebraska, pretty much every red state, according to The Economist, lives off of generally more liberal and developed states.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating when, like, you had that guy who called in an hour ago and was like, "Oh, it'll be paid back on a pro rata basis." Well, that's great. You know, tell West Virginia to start sending their money now.
Right. Well, and then the problem is that they just don't have it. But you're right. The red states are the takers. The blue states are the makers, and almost without exception, right across the board. And I don't have a solution for that other than to do a little better job of what we're doing right now, which is to try to raise the red states via opportunity. But the problem is they got these idiot governors who say things like, "No, we won't take your Medicare money." And, "No, we don't want, yes, we'll have more private prison industries, but no, we don't really want good business. And we're not going to teach our kids real science. We're going to teach them that the world is 6,000 years old. And that the best form of contraception is to just say no, et cetera, which, arguably it is. But, in the real world, you really need to have a plan B, C and D. So but Chris, excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Pete in Lake Zurich. Hey, Pete, you wanted to talk back to Reverend Keller.
Yeah, that was his name. I By the way, I love your show. I learn some every time I listen. I think most people would describe me as a conservative Christian, although becoming more progressive as I listen to you. But this guy, because Christian's a bad name, this guy was an idiot. I'm almost embarrassed to admit I'm a Christian when I have to, when people would perceive me to be like this yo-yo.
Well, this guy is a leader in the Christian community, or in the self-proclaimed Christian community. I mean, here's the weird conundrum. You know, I describe myself as a Christian, but if I showed up at Bill's church, I'm pretty sure they would not want me in there. So.
Well, that's what I said. These guys give the rest of us a bad name. I mean, There's no question. You are right. We've killed hundreds and thousands of Muslims. It is unconscionable. And to have people like him defend it.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous.
Yeah, it's not our religion they quote hate. It's not even our values that they quote hate. It's our behaviors, and they view our behaviors as we are killing them. And by the way, we are. We've killed hundreds of thousands of them just in the last decade. And I guarantee you, if Canada had killed hundreds of thousands of Americans in the last decade, we'd have some serious problems going on with Canada. And if they were of a different religion or of a different skin color than us, we'd have huge problems going on with them. So, Pete, thanks a lot for listening to WCPT. Well said. I appreciate the call. John in Downington, Pennsylvania. Hey, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Koran?
I'm calling also about Bill Keller.
Mm-hmm.
When he said that, you know, they're not trying to further our religion, and you know, how could they see us as attacking their religions? Remember when the Air Force was writing Bible verses on the bombs they were dropping? The torture of Abu Ghraib was performed in such a way as to be offensive to their religion. We're burning Qurans. The drone attacks at funerals, which are clearly religious ceremonies. You know,
right.
You're not having a secular funeral.
Right.
And, I don't understand how he could say that, you know.
And they all saw this stuff. I mean, it was on CNN, soldiers urinating on Qurans, burning Qurans. You got this right-wing minister down in Florida, Reverend Terry, what's his name? We had him on this program who said he was going to, you know, have us burn the Quran day. And then, yes, on CNN, I remember seeing the report of Bible verses being written on the sides of bombs that were destined to drop on Baghdad and kill children.
They were doing it to their flags. They were doing it to their religious icons and
yes.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah.
No, I'm with you, John. Americans just don't get it. We haven't figured out how to put ourselves in the other person's shoes, how to put ourselves in their position, and we need to. It's the key to empathy. John, thanks for the call. Chris, listening to WWRL in Kings Park, New York. Got a minute to the break, Chris. It's yours. What's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? It's a pleasure to be on the air.
Thank you.
I changed my question and my comment after listening to you for a little bit, but really, you know, my original thought was being somebody that's been through quote unquote the system, that's been through through welfare, that's been through the correctional process. It's quite disheartening to go somewhere and have people tell you that, no, you can't do this, this, and this because of your past.
Right.
And I don't think the general public gives people, you know, now I pulled myself out of that. I'm a civil service employee for New York City. I've, you know, come a long way since, you know, when I was younger. But still, I see a lot of people every day that are quite disheartened by, you know, the talk of such a generalization for the public or the community of, you know, welfare.
You're absolutely right. And this is particularly a problem in the minority community, and it's particularly a problem in that we have more people in prison than any country in the world. We really need to seriously reconsider how we're doing these things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Chris makes an absolutely excellent and important point. 27 minutes past the hour. Truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about, you know, we can't have people know that. The Trans-Pacific Partnership being negotiated in secret by 600 corporate lobbyists. No, we don't want to talk about that. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And in fact, I understand that was talked about while I was on a break. Right? I tuned into my own show for a little bit and thought, cool. I think it was Sam. Was doing a conversation with somebody about TPP. Good. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, I don't know where you find them people. You must have to go around lifting up rocks.
They are waving flags, Rick. They are all over. You know, if you go to any right wing website, these people are. Their names are just as well known as Bill Clinton's is on a left wing website.
You can't reason with people like that. You know, my son spent a good part of his young life over there. 3-4 tours. My daughter too. My son-in-law too.
Wow.
And none of them. You know, because they had to wise me up, because when this all started back 9/11, you know, I kind of fell for the bait. But
I'm still listening.
Yeah, and I went to the library. I wanted to do a little research. Mm. And, you know, the Four Dummies guides, that series of books?
Sure.
They got Muslim. I think it's...
The Dummies Guide to Islam?
Dummies. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, they have a word for Jesus and all that. And back in ancient times, before their religion was perverted, they worshipped women. They had a high place, just like in the Christian religion. They had a high place. And there's also, I believe they call them, that type of stuff just inflames people. You know, they don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the best doctors I know of in this state happen to be Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they're intelligent people. They're not all crazy. And there's another thing too. A lot of people don't realize the Saudis, they take all the profits, and it goes to the royal family, and the regular people don't get nothing, basically.
Right.
And when women finally get the right to vote over there, this stuff ain't going to go on.
I agree. And in fact, my thought is that the solution to much of the many of the world's problems is simply to fully empower women around the world. And it's not just a problem within Islam or within the Catholic Church, or within poor countries, or within countries that don't have a religion, or whatever it may be. This is just, you know, in general. Men have been oppressing women for 7,000 years, and it's got to come to an end if we're going to survive as a species. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. James in Belvedere, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, James, what's up?
I called the other day, but I agree with Franklin Roosevelt totally. You know, it's... you create demand, you'll run out of supply for to start with. And everybody
sure.
is in the world, I agree, you know, if you offer him a job that's better than the social safety net, he shows up to go to work, he ought to be employed.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You know, he's ready to go. He's ready to get out there and prove himself. There's no reason with the tax-based system we got that we can't create a manufacturing base that supports this country. You know, capitalism's great as long as you put a harness around it and you steer it in a direction that you need your country to go in.
Yes.
That benefits your people, because we are the government. We are the people. And so we could take our money collectively, because like George Bush gave a tax break, like $500, here's your refund check, and that's going to stimulate the economy. Yeah, well, that's all well and good, but you could buy products manufactured in China, you know? It's on an individual basis. It wasn't used collectively. Now, if he would have took that $500 and said, here, you tie it with your own money, but you have to buy something that's manufactured, produced, and sold retail in this country, and you got X amount of time to use it. And I would say anything that brings appreciable value back to your property, because home ownership or our homes are the nucleus of the economy anyway. Everything's contingent to homes, computers, cell phones, steel industry, oil industry. Everything is contingent to how healthy has that man's shelter over his head. You know, he's gonna obtain that before he goes out and buys a fancy car, something that's disposable. You'd be creating equitable wealth, which is your fabric, so you can spend that money in other sectors of the economy.
So what you're talking about, James, is generalizing the Buy America Act, which Franklin Roosevelt put in place in 1935 for government spending, which represents about 20% of the economy. And you're generalizing that to consumer spending, particularly consumers who are homeowners, which might be probably an additional 30 or 40% of America. I don't know the homeownership percentage right now. But doing that, I think that that's a fine idea. What I find particularly bizarre is that when Roosevelt put into place the Buy America Act, which said that any project, anything that's being done with federal money has to first source American-made goods, and they can only use non-American-made goods if they have a specific waiver from the executive branch that says, we can't find it, or it's not competitive, or it's not practical, and so we have to go to a foreign supplier. And up until the 1980s, virtually all government purchases were from American companies. The desks that are in government offices, I mean, you go into these government offices these days, they don't turn this stuff over really fast like they do in corporate America. And you will find desks that were made in Illinois, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts. You'll find chairs that, good old wooden chairs that were, made in the United States. You'll find, tables and furniture and light fixtures, and all this stuff was made in America. And the reason why is because you had to buy it if it was made in America. Then what Reagan did is he started willy-nilly signing these waivers, saying, anybody, the agency would come along and say, hey, we can get this, whatever it is, cheaper from China. And they'd say, okay, fine, here's a waiver. And basically the Buy America Act, no president since Reagan has enforced the Buy America Act. I mean, there's so much good stuff that's already on the books. The Buy America Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Reagan simply stopped and we could start again. And that's 20% of the economy. That right there would be enough to jumpstart a massive chunk of our economy. So, James, I'm totally with you. I think it's very, very well said. Thanks a lot for the call and appreciate it. Richard in Victorville, California. Hey, Richard.
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing good. I was listening to the gentleman that you were talking to a little while ago that was talking about the Muslim faith being a false religion.
Mm-hmm.
And he, the one thing that I've noticed lately, and it kind of goes back to the founding of this country. Most of our founding fathers came from European nations that had religious oppression. We were founded on one of the beliefs that we would have religious freedom.
Right.
But Christians in this country have become very intolerant of anyone who doesn't believe the way they believe.
Yep.
And it's like they want to run around and scream about how, they're Americans and they have the freedom to believe any way they want to. But if you're not part of their group, they look at you, they have no problems telling you that you're going to die and burn in hell. And, isn't this kind of like part of the reason that, the people who founded this country left where they were to begin with?
Yes, it is. And in fact, I'm looking for an article that I wrote sometime back called Talking Back to Judge Moore, or something about Judge Moore, and in which I've got this really, really cool quote from Jefferson about about exactly what you're talking about. And it's really cool because most people don't get this, don't get the whole background of this. And apparently it is not in my keeper's deck. I thought it was. It's not. Oh, well. And because what Jefferson, at the Jefferson Memorial, there's in the curved dome around the top, it says, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against anything that would, any form of tyranny over the mind of men." And so you think, oh, gee, the altar of God, he must have been a Bible thumper. When you read the entire letter in context, and it's not hard to find, and it's in my article, if you Google Tom Hartman and Judge Moore and Thomas Jefferson, it'll pop right up. When you read my article, what he said was he was writing a letter to James Madison, as I recall, and he said, or maybe it was Ben Rush, and it was just a few months before the election of 1800. And he said, these are very interesting times. And he said, but the numerous religions have come to me asking me to be like the official religion. And he said the Presbyterians in particular. And he said, but I got to read the entire, because it's so brilliant. So, but basically what he was saying was that the tyranny over the mind of man that he was referring to was the institutionalization of religion in the United States. And when you read that quote in context and you get it that the founders were like trying to avoid any state religion. I'm going to track this thing down while we'll be on. I got about a 5-second break here. Maybe somebody in the chat room has got it and share it with you. But I'll get back to it. It is so cool. But it is exactly your point, Richard. Thanks a lot for calling me for saying it. I appreciate it. We will be back. It is 44 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'll share it with you right after the break. Stick around. 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. In just a second, Alan Ratner is going to be with us, but I have to just share this quote with you. This is Thomas Jefferson on the verge of the 1800 election. He was running for president. He was 2 months out. He wrote this letter to Ben Rush, who was one of his best friends, who also was a deist. And he said, and a psychiatrist, Ellen says, yes, you're right. And he says, "Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vetum, which is the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press," he's talking about the First Amendment, "covered also the freedom of religion, has given the clergy a very favorable hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity through the United States. And as every sect believes its own one to be the true one, each one perhaps hopes for its own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country," he's talking about the probability of himself getting elected president, "threatens abortion to their hopes. And the preachers believe that any portion of power conferred to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes." And this is where we get to the quote that's on the top of the Jefferson Monument. "And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough too, in their opinion." End of quote. The quote has been taken completely out of context. Okay, back to Ellen Ratner. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Okay, your old friend, and this guy really is a friend. I always like to joke with you when the Republicans do terrible things. But Earl Blumenauer today...
Oh, Earl's a good guy.
He is a good guy. He introduced legislation which would reform the IRS code, been hearing a lot about the IRS lately, mm-hmm. to allow marijuana businesses legal at a state level to be in compliance with federal law. This is exactly like the gay marriage thing. So right now, if I hire a veteran, I get a tax credit. But if you hire a veteran and you're a marijuana business, you can't get a tax credit. So it's all of those kinds of things that people can get, but because the feds don't consider it a legal business.
So it's like the pot equivalent of doing away with DOMA.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Wow, that's so common sense.
Well, of course it's common sense, but can you imagine it getting it through the House?
Through the John Boehner, Eric Cantor.
Good luck. Okay. So, and he also said that because of this, people are in cash businesses, and because of that, there's a lot more robbery, but people pay 2 or 3 times more taxes because they can't take deductions, all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
Kind of interesting. Okay. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel today was at NATO in Brussels, Belgium. He said this was talking about the chemical weapons that supposedly the French have said and the United Nations has said that Syria has used sarin gas. And he basically said he hasn't seen evidence that they have, only what he reads in the newspapers. And therefore, he said, I think it's evidenced. I haven't seen any of the evidence in the last day and a half. He said, we're doing what we can to help Turkey, who's a part of NATO. But that's as far as he would go. He would not go any further on that.
Hmm. Which means, what's the subtext to that, in your opinion?
The subtext to that is we made a red line in the sand on chemical weapons. There's some evidence that they've been used. We don't want to go with that line in the sand because it would mean another war.
Right.
And so we're dancing around it rather than saying, well, you know, we've really evaluated this. This is not in our interest or in anybody's interest to go into this.
Yeah, I agree with that point.
Right, of course.
The last thing we need is another war in the Middle East.
Exactly, and sending in troops and craziness.
Especially,
but just saying,
especially when Russia's on the
inside. We made a mistake. All right. Now, also, as you know, yesterday, Saxby Chambliss, who is a senator from Georgia who is not running for re-election in 2014, made a remark about hormones and all this with sexual assault. Today, Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, went after him. He said, it's simple. Criminals are responsible for sexual assaults, not hormones.
Yes. Well said.
So that's kind of interesting. Okay, some other things. Today, two IRS staffers have now been placed on administrative leave. We don't know why it is. We do know that they went to that very expensive conference, the one in California, where there was somebody that was playing, I don't know, Star Trek or Star Wars or whatever. He's actually coming before Congress tomorrow, Daryl Issa's committee. But basically, two people have been placed on administrative leave because they apparently got free food and gifts. You cannot do that when you're a federal employee.
I wonder if they claimed the deduction or if they claimed it as income.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The TSA, finally, you know, first they said they would allow small knives on the plane. Then they put that off. Now they have finally said, after they've heard from everybody, particularly the airline pilots, airline flight attendants association, passengers association, and a lot of other people, that they're finally not going to allow small knives on planes.
So I'm sitting on a plane yesterday flying home from Portland, and I got a zillion frequent flyer miles, so we upgraded to first class. And they bring us a salad.
A knife.
Yeah. I'm sitting here with a metal knife in my hand going, that's interesting.
Well, they're going to say that that's not the kind of sharp box cutters, et cetera, that were used in 9/11.
Give me 5 minutes with a file in the bathroom.
Right.
I shouldn't talk like
no,
that. No, I mean, but I think what it is that, not that I would do it, obviously, but I think that we are, I'm just not afraid on airplanes, Ellen. I am convinced after 9/11, that if anybody is doing anything threatening, that the other passengers are going to take them down.
Oh,
we don't even need sky marshals. They took down a flight attendant who was going nuts because she'd taken the wrong medication.
Right.
They've taken down schizophrenic people. They've taken, you know, it's...
People don't put up with it anymore.
No. I'm not afraid.
Okay. So it's very interesting. The Republican Jewish Coalition has a very different reaction to the president, President Obama's appointment of Susan Rice and Samantha Powers. They particularly went after Samantha Powers, that is the Republican Jewish Coalition, saying that her records and statements against Israel are very troubling. So you can imagine exactly what's going to happen on that.
Yeah, that one's not going to work out well. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a freed slave in South Sudan and get a picture of your goat and the person that you help, probably taken by Ellen herself, sitting right here. Although she'll be
going
sitting
in
over
2 weeks.
There. Going in 2 weeks to Sudan.
Yeah.
Good on you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, one of the hits on President Obama that the Republicans are so fond of, so terribly fond of, that I think is bizarre, is that he's like Jimmy Carter, as if Jimmy Carter was a weak president. When I think back to the end of the Carter presidency, we had just a few weeks ago when, what was it called? Argo was this movie that came out that was that won an Academy Award or some sort of an award. And it was about a group of, not the main group of hostages, but another group of hostages who kind of got out of Iran by this filmmaker got in and took them out, and a whole long story. Anyhow, It was, you know, great movie. But in the movie, what you saw was that all these Iranians were all upset with all these Americans and death to America and all this kind of stuff. And when this came out, Mr. Bonnie Sauter, who was the president of Iran, he was actually a politician who was not president of Iran when the hostages were taken. And in the summer of 1980, he ran for president of the United of Iran on a platform of releasing the hostages. And he wrote an op-ed about this in the Christian Science Monitor, which you can still read today. It's fairly hard to find because almost everybody ignored it. I was astounded it wasn't reprinted everywhere, that it didn't appear on the front page of the New York Times. But here's he ran on a platform of releasing the hostages, and he won overwhelmingly. That the average Iranian didn't give a rat's patootie that we were holding the hostages. In fact, most of them were embarrassed about it. They wanted their country to let the hostages go. They saw it as unnecessarily inflaming tensions between the United States and Iran. Bonnie Sauter ran on that platform. He won. And then he went to the Ayatollahs, who, you know, they're sort of like our Supreme Court, right? We think that we have a democracy. We have a constitutional monarchy. You want to do something, you got to go to the Ayatollahs. The nine people in black robes, you know, just down the street here at the Supreme Court, and said, can I do this? Are you sure? Is it constitutional? Well, in Iran, they've got the Ayatollahs who are, you know, functionally their Supreme Court. Instead of looking at their constitution, they look at their Quran. But it's the same thing. So Bonnie Sauter goes to the Ayatollahs and he says, okay, I ran on a platform of releasing the hostages. May I please release the hostages? And Ayatollah Khomeini said, no, you can't. And he told him why. And Bonnie Sauter published this just weeks ago in the Christian Science Monitor. Like I said, you can read it online. Sue will put a link to it tomorrow on Sue's stack in our newsletter and on our website. You can read it online. The Ayatollah said to Bonnie Sauter, to President Bonnie Sauter, you may not release those hostages because we cut a deal with the Ronald Reagan campaign. Keep in mind, Reagan was running against Carter in the summer of 1980 for president of the United States. And Carter was way ahead. Reagan was considered a crackpot. They called him Ronnie Reagan. Everybody was afraid he was going to start a nuclear war. We thought of him as Slim Pickens in that movie, you know, Dr. Strangelove, just riding the bomb down there with his cowboy hat in his hand, going woo, yeah. So he goes to the Ayatollah. And he says, "I got a lot of." He says, nope, we cut a deal with the Reagan campaign that we would hold those hostages until after the election, and we are going to do that. In exchange for that, they are going to ship us spare parts for all of our weapons, because, you know, we've got a whole military here, and it's all American-made weapons, and we can't legally buy them from the United States. And in fact, Israel has already started to deliver some of those weapons, some of those spare parts, specifically tires for their F-18s for their fighter jets. Israel was already delivering them. And Bonnie Sauter talks about this in his op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor. And they kept those hostages and they released them literally the moment that Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible in January of 1981, as he was being sworn in. They released the hostages at that moment. Everybody said, oh, that's because they hate Carter so much. No, it's because they were keeping a deal. It was their way of saying to Ronald Reagan, we will expose you. We're going to get this close to exposing you. We will expose you if you don't get those weapons to us. And so Reagan kept his word. Through 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86. Finally got busted in 86. Selling weapons to Iran. And taking the money from that, and there had been this piece of legislation passed that specifically said that the Reagan administration, because everybody knew Reagan was such a warmonger. I mean, he was a crazy guy. That he wanted to go after the Contras in Nicaragua. Oh, my God, there's a communist government. Well, it's a socialist government in Nicaragua. please don't start a war in Nicaragua, Mr. Reagan. So they literally, Congress passed a law making it illegal for Reagan to start a war with Nicaragua. So what does he do? He takes the money from Iran, from selling them the weapons, which he was selling them because they helped him win the election. He takes that money and he gives it to the rebels and thugs and murderers, right wing death squads in Nicaragua, the so called Contras. Ollie North is helping him do it. Ollie North took the fall for it. And then Gerry Ford pardons the whole bunch of them. George Herbert Walker Bush pardons the whole bunch of them. The same way Gerry Ford had pardoned Nixon and his cronies. So it just got me thinking, if Jimmy Carter's second term had not been stolen, what would America be like right now? This is what Jimmy Carter had to say about fossil fuels. The first thing I want to tell you is if Jimmy Carter had not had that election stolen, if Ronald Reagan and Bill Casey, who is the guy who set this up, who was running his campaign, if Bill Casey had not committed treason to get Reagan and Bush into office by cutting a deal with the enemy, just like we know Nixon did, by the way, back when LBJ was president and Hubert Humphrey, his vice president, was running for re-election or for election in 68. We got the tape on that of LBJ talking to Everett Dirksen about this. Here we've got the testimony of the president of Iran. I would submit to you that 9/11 wouldn't have happened because we wouldn't have been in the Middle East pumping oil. And we would not be at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And if 9/11 had not happened, we would not have a war in Afghanistan or Iraq. This would be a prosperous country. We would be energy independent. Here's what Carter had to say. In 1979, here he is.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Right. And he put that into place. He actually put that into place. And had Ronald Reagan not come into office the next year and blown it up, we would not be using foreign oil, and we would not be in the Middle East, and they could be growing turnips for all we care. And we would not be at 400 parts per million. We would not be looking at a possible extinction event. But that's just the beginning of it. Let me tell you some of the other things that the Carter administration did and how different America would be if we hadn't had three consecutive Republican treasonous actions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And by that, I'm talking about the Supreme Court installing George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan cutting a deal with the Iranians, and Richard Nixon cutting a deal with the South Vietnamese. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Okay, so Jimmy Carter, I think one of the great presidents of the 20th century. He was one of the only presidents to not have a war during his presidency. He did not go off and start a war in Grenada like Reagan did. He didn't have like a little war of convenience. George Herbert Walker Bush, let's do 100 days in, Kuwait. George W. Bush, of course, has some big wars. Jimmy Carter, no war. He created the Department of Energy and the Department of Education to make America energy independent and well-educated. This is why, Bill Bennett was running in the primary against Ronald Reagan in 1980 on the platform of doing away with the Department of Education, which Jimmy Carter had just created. And the whole point of the Department of Education was so that kids who are born in poor neighborhoods and poor areas could have access to funding so that they could come up to the standards of kids who were lucky enough to be born in wealthy and affluent areas. But not only did Jimmy Carter say we will never import more oil, more foreign oil than we did last year, he went a step beyond that. By 2000, that's 13 years ago. By the year 2000, he was going to have 20% of the electricity in this country produced by solar energy, and he started with the White House. They put solar panels on the White House. Here's Jimmy Carter on that.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
There you go. By the year 2000, 20%. And he did it. When Louise and I were in Vermont, what was it, two, 3 weeks ago, I gave that keynote address at Goddard College in outside of Montpelier. And we were staying with our friends, Hal and Shelley Cohen, and they live in a house off the grid. There's literally no electricity line coming to their house. They got solar panels on the roof. And this is a fairly large house. I mean, it's like three or four bedrooms. It's not some little shack. And it's totally solar, totally off the grid. And it was built during the last year of the Carter presidency, as were solar houses. And Vermont is like a really cold place. But this was, as were houses all over the country. When you find solar houses, you will almost universally find, you will discover that they were built in the 1980s, in the late 1970s, the last 2 years of the Carter administration, or maybe the first year of the Reagan administration before he did away with Carter's subsidies and tax credits for building solar. Because that's how Carter was going to do it. He was going to have it. The market was going to drive it. It wasn't going to be a government program. It was tax breaks, tax credits, tax incentives for people who are going solar. So we would have that. We'd probably have peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for the work he was doing on this. And he would have finished it if Reagan hadn't stolen that election. There's a documentary. It's called Backdoor Channels, The Price of Peace. Came out in 2009. That says that it was Carter's efforts at Camp David that brought peace between Israel and Egypt, with bringing the only meaningful peace to the Middle East. Schools all over America would be better. If he did create the Department of Education, he cared about schools. He was a very smart guy. This is a guy who had I believe he has a PhD in nuclear energy. He worked on nuclear subs when he was in the Navy. The tax rate on rich people during the Carter presidency was 74%. Now, it wasn't 74% of the first $100,000 you earned, the first $200,000. It was in today's dollars, it was 74% roughly on the after you earn your first $2 or $3 million, then the 74% rate kicks in. That's how progressive taxation works. But what would that have meant? It would have meant that just like the era from 1935 to 1982, when the top tax rate was above 50%, there were no bubbles and there were no bursts. There was no boom, there was no bust. Because money was dear, money was hard to get. I mean, a lot of money really fast. Once Reagan dropped that top tax rate, then all of a sudden, oh boy, you know, the rich got richer faster and faster and faster, and they started looking for big rates of return. And this money cost me almost nothing to get this money. So 25% rate of return, 30%, I realize I might lose it all, but what the heck? And what do you get? You get bubbles. We're still there. So we would not have had the economic disaster that we've had. We would have a good, strong, healthy economy. Civil rights. He, in his inaugural speech, he said the era of segregation is over. Discrimination has no place in the future of the state. And by the way, he was the first office holder in the Deep South to say such a thing in public. He pointed African Americans to statewide boards and offices. He was often called one of the new Southern governors, much more moderate than their predecessor. They had actually a name for them. Oh, he's a new Southern governor. What? In other words, he's not a racist. In 79, Love Canal happened. This is in the middle of his presidency. He moved 800 families out of the neighborhood and created the Superfund. Yeah, Jimmy Carter created the Superfund to deal with this. In 79, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Now, Reagan, a year later, said, oh, well, let's start giving weapons to the Mujahideen, to this guy named Osama bin Laden, and he will fight the Soviets. But Carter instead said, we're just going to boycott the Moscow Olympics of 1980. He said, we will make a moral statement rather than a military statement. And in the years since Jimmy Carter was president, he visited Cuba in May of 2002, and he gave a speech which he wrote in Spanish and he delivered in Spanish on Cuban television, live and uncensored, and Castro did not even know what he was going to say. And he condemned Castro. In 2007, he joined Nelson Mandela with this group called the Elders. He built houses in Vietnam.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm telling you, if Jimmy Carter, if we need to rehabilitate the memory of Jimmy Carter. And anytime anybody says Obama's Carter, I want to say, yes, I wish. Bad and the very, very obmutisantly ugly. The good. The Connecticut legislature. On Monday, the Nutmeg State became the first state in the country to approve mandatory labeling for GMO foods. The state legislature passed the bill by a vote of 134-3, and Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy is expected to sign it. Although Alaska approved a bill requiring the labeling of genetically modified seafood in 2005, Connecticut is the only state to require GMO labeling for the food industry writ large. Although the law will not take effect until four other states pass similar legislation, it sends a strong message to big ag companies like Monsanto that the American people are waking up to what's going on with their food. Good work, Connecticut. Justice Brandeis was right. The states are truly the laboratories of democracy. The bad. Senator Saxby Chambliss. During yesterday's hearings on the military's ongoing sexual assault crisis, the Georgia senator said that the government had to be careful how it tried to prevent rapes because such incidents are the natural result of hormone levels. Seriously, take a listen.
The young folks that are coming into each of your services are anywhere from 17 to 22 or 3. Gee whiz, that's the level of the hormone level created by nature sets in place the possibility for these types of things to occur. So we've got to be very careful how we address it on our side.
No, Senator, sexual assault, any kind of assault actually, isn't some logical outgrowth of male sexuality. It's a degrading violation of individual autonomy. And comments like that perpetuate the sort of rape culture that makes the military's assault crisis so difficult to solve in the first place. And the very, very ugly Edith Jones. According to a lawsuit filed Tuesday by a group of civil rights activists, Jones, a judge for the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, has a problem with a racial bias. Actually, a huge problem. An affidavit signed by the plaintiffs claims that she told a University of Pennsylvania audience in February that, quote, racial groups like African Americans and Hispanics are predisposed to crime and prone to commit acts of violence, end quote. She also reportedly claimed that, quote, Mexicans would prefer to be on death row in the United States than serving prison terms in other countries, end quote. We can only hope that the accusations against Jones are false, because if they are true, that means an American public official entrusted with objectively enforcing the law is doing her job under the influence of extreme prejudice and racism. And that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. So if Jimmy Carter had not, if Bill Casey and Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush had not stolen the election of 1980, America would be a very different place. And, of course, for those of you who haven't heard the program before or might be new to it, if you want to, Shano, dig out the clip of LBJ talking to Senator Everett Dirksen, you have it handy? Okay, good. Back in 1968, we were halfway into the Vietnam War. I was out in the streets, you know, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? It was a rough time. And Vice President Hubert Humphrey was running for election as president against Richard Nixon. And he was going to win. Humphrey was far enough away from Johnson, and he was in particular going to win because Johnson and Humphrey had been doing these peace talks in Paris with the Vietnamese, and they had achieved a negotiated settlement that would have allowed America to bring our troops out. I mean, it was done. It was a done deal. And they were going to release the results of this in October. It was the original October surprise. I mean, you can argue about the politics of it. You could say it's dirty politics. But, hey, you know, Johnson was the president. He was using the power of the presidency. He ended the war. The Nixon people found out about it, and they went to the people in South Vietnam, to Madam Tu, and he went to them and he said, stop negotiating. Do not declare peace. And I will give you, I will make you rich, and I will give you a better deal than Johnson is giving you. Nixon said he would give you them a better deal if they just waited until after the election. Just like, you know, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Bill Casey cut with the Iranians in 1980. This was in 1968. Lyndon Johnson took that secret to his grave, as did Hubert Humphrey. They both knew about it. But after he died, he left this recording in his library, and this was released 3 years ago by the Johnson Library. This is brand new stuff. This is an actual recording of Lyndon Johnson talking to Senator Everett Dirksen, who was he was sort of the I guess the Harry Reid of the day. It was a Republican, but he was the leader of the Senate Republicans, the leader. And Everett Dirksen was one of the most honorable men. I mean, you say what you want about his politics. Everett Dirksen was an incredibly honorable man. He was a great politician. They named the Dirksen Senate Office Building over here after him in recognition of, he was brilliant and a good man. He had this deep, resonant voice. I remember Everett Dirksen. And here's the conversation between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen about how Johnson, the CIA, has been wiretapping the Nixon campaign because they've been wiretapping the conversations going in and out of Vietnam. And guess who's calling? The Nixon campaign. The guys out in New Mexico where the campaign's being run are calling into Vietnam. And LBJ basically says, I'm reading their hand. I got the cards here. I know what's going on. And if I tell the American people will be so shocked, they will lose faith in the American system. And we cannot allow that to happen. We can't tell the American people that one of the two people running for president of the United States is a traitor. So this has to stop. He's basically saying, Everett, you got to get him to stop. This is treason. And Everett says, I know. And then there are subsequent conversations over the next week or so where Everett reports back to him, and we've got all those here too, but I'll just play this one for you just so you know what I'm talking about, where Everett Dirksen says, I've talked to Nixon, and he's just not willing to, you know, budge. He's going to win the election. And Johnson says, okay, I'm not going to out this. I'm not going to take it to the press. Here's the conversation.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. This is that treason is how Richard Nixon became president of the United States in 1968. Let that sink in for a minute. And then, as I said, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, whenever it was the week of the Academy Awards, whenever that was. I'm lousy with time. A month ago. President Bonnie Sauter of Iran writes a piece for the Christian Science Monitor in which he lays out that he was elected on a platform in 1980 of freeing the hostages in the summer of 1980. And then he was told by the Ayatollah, you can't release the hostages until after the election because we've cut a deal with the Reagan campaign. Reagan is running against Jimmy Carter. Yellow ribbons tied on trees. As a result of that, as a result of Carter's inability, his impotence. I mean, he sent a helicopter and he tried to rescue these guys. It crashed. People died. Republicans made fun of him on national television. And he lost the election because Reagan had committed treason. And then fast forward another dozen or so years, and you've got George Herbert Walker Bush. A 500,000 votes down. Al Gore had a 500,000 more votes than George Herbert Walker Bush. And Florida was the pivotal state, so his brother knocks 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls in Florida because they have names similar to felons in Texas. And even that wasn't enough because they were 500 votes apart. And so the Supreme Court of Florida says we're going to recount all the votes in the whole state. And a year later, when the New York Times actually took those truckloads worth of ballots and manually counted them all, they found that by any measure, Al Gore actually won that election. But the Supreme Court stopped the count. They overruled the Florida Supreme Court, which, by the way, is a blatant violation of the 10th Amendment. And to this day, Sandra Day O'Connor regrets this. She's come out publicly and said that she regrets this. So what's the net of this? The last legitimately elected Republican president in the history of the United States in the 20th century, the last legitimately elected president was Dwight Eisenhower. And Dwight Eisenhower ran on a campaign. You got the clip? He ran on a campaign of vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. Here is Dwight Eisenhower's campaign commercial.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Vote for peace. That was the last legitimately elected Republican president. And his slogan, his campaign slogan, TV ads, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. Think how different America would be if three Republicans, Nixon, Reagan Bush, and Bush, had not committed treason and illegitimately sat in the White House. How different would this country be? It's mind-boggling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Call me a conspiracy theorist all you want. The evidence is right there for you to read. Nobody is disputing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, many of you are listening to us on radio. About an equal number of people are watching us on television because we're syndicated as TV by the Free Speech TV Network, which is on Dish Satellite Network and on DirecTV and on cable systems all over the country. And a number of the people watching on TV have called in to notice that I am wearing my left arm in a sling. And I was a couple of days ago, the last time I was on, and just wanting to know what's going on. What's the deal? I just finished this book, The Crash of 2016. We just submitted it to the publisher, Hachette. It'll be coming out in November. And it's like 4 years ago. If you've been watching for a long time, you'll remember my right arm was in a sling. And I had just finished a book. My recollection was it was Rebooting the American Dream. And I think it's a repetitive strain injury. You just type like crazy for hours and hours and hours and hours, all day long and on weekends and things. And so, I got an MRI done. I went to the doctor, and they said that my rotator cuff tendon is half torn, and my biceps are all inflamed, and there's all kinds of, muscle damage in there. And I think it's from typing, frankly. Either that or, Louise and I joined this gym to try and get back in shape, and I might have just done something stupid on a machine. But whatever it is, if I keep it in the sling and I just, treat it well, then it will slowly heal. Matter of months, hopefully. And if I tear it all away, then I got to do surgery. So I'm doing everything I can to avoid tearing it all away. But as long as I'm wearing the sling, it doesn't hurt. So that's that, and we won't talk about it anymore. but just FYI. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Tom, you're just amazing. There's one quote of yours that I'll always
remember, which should have earned someone the Nobel Prize for Economics, and that was the one about true wealth percolating up from the ground and not dropping down as, you know, trickle down.
Yeah. In fact, the infrastructure of our nation is the soil in which business roots itself. You know, that's why we need to build that infrastructure.
That's right. My first election was 1972 when I registered as an independent because of everything that had happened since 1968. And I voted for McGovern. And I, you know, pretty much voted Democratic or Working Families Party ever since. But I lived through Jimmy Carter. And as much as I agree with you, there were some, he had some issues during his presidency.
Oh, he had a bunch of them.
Yeah, with the cronies all around them, the Burt Lances and all the petty crime going on. But yeah. Also, didn't he start the privatization move under his administration, which
yes.
Reagan?
Well, here's what happened. Here's what happened. In 1978, 2 years into the Carter administration, Maggie Thatcher was elected Prime Minister of England. And she came in, and the first thing she did was break the coal union, which was the strongest and most powerful and oldest union in Great Britain. Nobody thought it could be done. She crushed that union. And then she started the privatization of the railroad, the privatization of the post office. She just went on a bender. And many of the economists surrounding Carter at that time were starting to seriously listen to Milton Friedman, who had been considered a crackpot up until that time. And he had just been given the Nobel Prize in economics a couple of years earlier by a bank in Sweden, not even by the Nobel Committee. They created this prize in the memory of Alfred Nobel in economics just so they could give it to Friedman. And so Carter was drinking the privatization Kool-Aid, and he privatized the airlines. And I know that very well because in 83, Louise and I started a travel agency in Atlanta and, you know, exploited that privatization. We made a fair amount of money and, you know, over 3 years built that up, got it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and sold it off in 86 and you know, went off and lived in Europe and did social work. But the bottom line is that Carter, he deregulated the trucking industry and the air travel industry. And over the short term, it looked like it was really good stuff and it was working and it was boosting them. Over the long term, what it did is it led to monopoly and it led us to where we are here. I think they were the horrible mistakes of his administration. So, yeah, I'm not saying he was a perfect president, but...
No, but, you know. Right. But, I mean, in terms of it's amazing how much Reagan really destroyed everything that was just there. You know,
yeah.
It was like
yeah.
in our grasp, we had the brass ring, you know, and Reagan and his crew just kind of mowed through the whole thing.
Yep. Yeah. Really, yeah. The whole Reaganomics, trickle down economics, supply side economics. It was general insanity. Didn't we already give a? No, we haven't. Oh, okay. Cool. Mark, Shano tells me that you are the one person who's going to receive a copy of our book today. So I'm going to put you on hold. Mark is on line 5 for Danielle, and we're going to send you a copy of Screwed: The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Autographed by me. It's a hardcover copy and brought to you by Stamps.com. So thank you, Mark, for listening on WWRL. Nick in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Nick, thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to talk about the person that you were talking to earlier about Muslims. And, you know, it just surprises me to no end, you know, how these people talk about Muslims. You know, it's really sad. You know, I have never really seen, you know, a situation where Christianity cannot be tied. I mean, that Islam is not so similar to Christianity. I mean, there are so many parallels
mm-hmm.
between it, and it's just amazing how they can go out on this limb trying to make it like they have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
Islam
came out of, you know, in part Christianity and part out of Judaism. I mean, we all share the Old Testament.
Well, and, you know, it's amazing how they, you know, they love to say that all these people, you know, they're talking about their religion and they're doing all these things for their religion. It's the same on the other side.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Nick, I'm sorry we're out of time, but you're absolutely right. Thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio there. We will be back tomorrow. We'll have the latest news and information from Wall Street, Main Street, and all the points in between. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. We had a great fundraiser on Saturday for Progressive Democrats of America in Los Angeles with Lily Tomlin. Go to pdamerica.org and check it out. Help them out. And don't forget, it all starts with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.